Well, it's good to see you. Good to have the opportunity to come together and to associate with each other and to enjoy some of the relationships that we have in Christ, but to turn our minds to more important things, to the study of God's Word. If you would please open your Bibles to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7. I told Richard a while ago I'm not real happy with my charts. I'm going to redo them. So I may or may not use them, probably won't, in our study this morning, but I'll prepare them again for him to use next week in my absence. But the chapter itself provides for us a marvelous outline. The chapter that we're studying, Acts chapter 7 and Acts chapter 13, when the Apostle Paul preaches to the Jews there in Antioch of Pisidia, we see a similar presentation of the history of God dealing with his people. And so what we want to do in our study this morning is to look at the accusations that are made against Stephen and then see his response. In our study this morning, we're looking at the accusations against Stephen at the latter part of Acts chapter 6. And I'm going to pass over some of these things just because. The accusations against Stephen in the latter part of chapter 6. And I want you to look at that, if you would please. We know that Stephen has been selected as one of the seven to take care of the Grecian widows there in the church in Jerusalem. But in verse 11 of this text, Acts chapter 6, it says, "Then they suborned men who said, 'We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God.' And they stirred up the people and the elders and the scribes and came upon him and seized him and brought him unto the council and set up false witnesses who said, 'This man ceaseth not to speak words against this holy place and the law. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered unto us.' And all that sat in the council fastened their eyes on him and saw his face as it had been an angel." Now, the accusations that are made against Stephen in this context are absolutely crucial to the arrangement, I guess would be a good word, of the presentation of Stephen's defense in Acts chapter 7. And I want you to look at those. What is it that Stephen is blatantly accused of? Number one, blasphemy against Moses and against God. You're guilty of blasphemy. What do they accuse Stephen of doing? Speaking against God, speaking against Moses. What else? In verse 13. All right, yes, you've spoken against the temple and you've spoken against the law. Now we see that relationship unto Moses. But several things in this that set out a very specific pattern for the defense that Stephen makes in Acts chapter 7. Now, if you were being accused of those things, you might think, well, the best way to defend myself is just say that ain't so. Well, how are you going to prove it? And that's what Stephen does. That's not so. And here's what I've been preaching, and here's what you have historically been doing. And I think the arguments are just profound. Of course, keep in mind they're made by inspiration, but they ought to impress us in our efforts to try to teach somebody that's not a Christian, to build ourselves up. Yes?
Is there the accusations continue in verse 14?
Yes, they do. If you would, read that for me, please.
"For we have heard him say that this Nazarene Jesus will destroy this place and alter the customs which Moses handed down to us."
All right, so those are related to the temple. He's accused or said that Jesus would destroy the temple, this place, that's what's identified, and then speaking against the law, the customs that Moses has delivered unto us. Now, the question in chapter 7, verse 1, are these things so? Now, that just gives Stephen a platform. Are these things so? Now, for our purposes, I'm going to just shut that off. Like I said, I'm not happy with that. And use the text for our outline. In verse 2, we see the beginning of Stephen's speech. And Randy, could I get you to read for me just a little bit? And I'm going to stop you every once in a while. If you'll be my reader, we'll stop and go and stop and go. But begin there at verse 2. And if you would please read down through verse 4.
Acts 7, 2 through 4. And he said, "Hear me, brethren and fathers. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, 'Leave your country and your relatives, and come into the land which I will show you, that I will show you.' Then he left the land of the Chaldeans and settled in Haran. From there, after his father died, God had him moved to this country in which you are now living."
All right, let's notice that it took a while. We've studied this in our history and geography study to go all the way from Mesopotamia to Haran and then on down into the land of Canaan. But we note this pause in Haran. And I want you to look, if you will, in the text of Genesis chapter 11 and see where Abraham is and then see what he is told in chapter 12. Genesis chapter 11, the last verse or two of that. Genesis chapter 11, verse 31 is where I want to read. Chris, would you read that for me, please? 31 and 32.
"And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarah his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran."
All right, I want to make note just here that this conversation that begins in chapter 12, where God is giving instruction unto Abram, is in Haran. Do we see that? But where then does Stephen say that this all began? In Mesopotamia. So we're right back over here. It's where this started. Now he's traveled up here and then coming down into the land of Canaan. But God had said way over here in Mesopotamia, according to what Stephen relates, and that begins now in chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. Randy, please. Genesis 12, 1, 2, and 3.
Genesis 12, 1, 2, and 3. "The Lord said to Abram, 'Go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse.'"
What's God promised unto Abraham? Three things. Rick?
I'm finished.
Okay, go ahead.
"And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed."
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. Three blessings here, or three statements, Rick. What are they? Yes, I'll make of you a great nation. Number two. All right, involved in that is what we sometimes refer to as the seed promise. "In thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed." And then what's number three? We don't have them exactly in order, but that'll work. We've got the nation promise, and we've got the seed promise, and then what's the other one? The nation promise. "I'm going to make of you a great nation of people." The land, nation, and seed, if I can get those in the order in which they are stated, and then the order in which they are fulfilled is the land, or the nation promise first, the land promise second. I didn't get that right. The land promise first, the nation promise second, and then the seed promise is the way that they are given, and then they are fulfilled with the nation promise first. Hopefully I'll make that clear. Might muddy the water a little bit. But I want to see that this is what Stephen has said, that God said unto Abraham in while he was in Mesopotamia. Get thee out, verse 3 of Acts chapter 7. "Get thee out of thy land and from thy kindred and come into the land that I will show thee." What land was it that God was going to show him? The land of Canaan, yes. We know that they went into the land that God promised in Joshua chapter 1, well, through the book, but Joshua leading them into that land. But specifically in Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 and 44, Joshua said that God has given you the land. What land? The land which He promised unto your fathers, and you have possessed it, and you dwell in it. Now that's a passage that we want to make special note of. Don't forget that. Joshua chapter 21 in verses 43 and 44. Now you remember that Joshua also told them prior to his death in Joshua chapter 23, beginning in verse 16. What has God done? Everything He promised. Remember the expression? Not one thing hath failed. Not one thing. But if you worship and serve other gods, what's He going to do to you? He'll drive you out of this good land. Now, what I want to note in Stephen's presentation is that Stephen hits on every one of these things. The accusation, Stephen, is that you're preaching against Moses. You're preaching against the law. You're preaching against the temple. You're preaching against the customs of Moses. And in relation to all that, Stephen answers every one of them, and he shows that, no, it's not me that's been preaching against these things. But rather, historically, that has been you. Now, I want you to look, if you will, please, in the text of Acts chapter 7, and if I can get on the right spot here, I want to be on. We'll look in Acts chapter 7 and note specifically some verses, and then we'll go back in and fill in the blanks. In verse 26 and 27 and 8, Randy, would you read that for me? Acts 7, 26, 27, and 28.
Following day he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them to peace, saying, "Men, you are brethren, why do you injure one another?" But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you?"
Give me the setting, if you will. The Old Testament setting.
He's recounting the story where Moses broke up the fight between two Hebrews and said, "What are you fighting about? Your brother." But that was the day after he had killed an Egyptian.
All right, so what was Moses trying to do, and what was the response of the Israelites?
He was trying to stop fighting. Their response was they rejected him as their rulers.
Yeah.
Who do you think you are?
Right.
And the bosses around.
Now, while Moses is over here in the land of Midian, God speaks to him in the form of a burning bush and so forth, and time passes. Jump fast forward to Moses comes back to the land of Egypt to lead the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt. What was their response to Moses? "Oh, we're glad you're here. We're happy to exit this awful place." Is that how they responded? How did they respond to Moses' interest in them leaving Egypt? Well, yeah, the point being is when the plagues began to come, they saw the miracles, but as soon as they crossed over the Red Sea and exited the land of Egypt, they cried out and murmured and complained multiple times and suffered the consequences of it. Regarding Moses' leadership, again, they rejected it. Now, if you continue reading in the text of Acts chapter 7, Randy, drop down, if you will, to verse... Find the verse. Verse 39. Here the law has been given. Verse 38, if you'd read that too as well. Verse 38 and 39.
"This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel who was speaking to him on Mount Sinai, and who was with our fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to him. Our fathers were unwilling to be obedient to him, but repudiated him, and their hearts turned back to Egypt."
Interesting, isn't it? He gave them the law. Were they receptive of Moses when he gave them the law? No. Who rejected the Israelites did? Your fathers, Stephen points out. That's what you did. And what did they say then to Aaron in verse 40? "Make us gods to go before us. For this Moses, we know not what's become of him." And so they made for themselves a golden calf. Now, number 3, in verse 44. Randy, while you're reading, verse 44 and 45. Please.
44 and 45. Our fathers had the tabernacle of testimony in the wilderness, just as he who spoke to Moses directed him to make it according to the pattern which he had seen. And having received it in their turn, our fathers brought it in with Joshua upon dispossessing the nations which God drove out before our fathers until the time of David.
All right, go ahead and get 46 too, please.
David found favor in God's sight and asked that he might find a dwelling place for God, for the God of Jacob.
All right, verse 47, Solomon built him a house, built the temple. Now, our point is this. When God gave instruction to Moses regarding the building of a tabernacle, when God gave instruction then to Solomon regarding the building of the temple, what was the response of the people? Well, they thought that, well, God dwells in this house as if he is like the idol gods. Look, if you will, at the words of the Old Testament prophet, Isaiah 66. He said, "Howbeit the Most High dwelleth not in houses made with hands, as saith the prophet, the heaven is my house, and the earth the footstool of my feet. What manner of house will ye build me, saith the Lord, or what is the place of my rest? Did not my hand make all these things?" What did they perceive of the temple? What was it to be to them? I guess the question that I'm asking, and not doing a very good job of it, is what was their attitude toward the temple? Was it simply a place of significance as God dwelt among them, or did they put the temple itself on some kind of a pedestal? Why are they so upset when Jesus said, "Destroy this temple and I'll raise it again in 3 days"? Why are they so upset when Stephen has said that about Jesus?
The Holy of Holies was in the temple.
All right, it was.
I was just going to say that they had turned it into a place of merchandise.
Yes, this was the focus, the temple. And it wasn't that this is where God dwells among us. This is the temple. This is our place. And so the significance of a structure, a building, I guess is the point I'm trying to emphasize here, is what they perceived from the temple. And when Jesus said, and when Stephen said, "Tear it down, build it again in 3 days," what they see is their center of culture, their center of worship, the focus of their nation being brought down. Now, in reality, when we think about what the temple represented, was it just simply brick and mortar and stone and all kinds of beautiful things? Is that all the significance of the temple? What did it represent to them?
Actually, the dwelling place of God.
All right, it was, in fact, a symbol of the dwelling place of God. Now, let me ask you, is there any parallel of that in the New Testament? If you look in Ephesians, the second chapter, and pick up the reading about verse 20, we'll back up to verse 19. Again, to set the stage while you're turning to that, the apostle is writing to the church in Ephesus that has problems between Jews and Gentiles. And the relationship between the Jews and Gentiles, to say the least, is strained. And picking up the reading there, Randy, at verse 19, read on down through, if you will, the rest of the chapter.
Ephesians 2, 19 through 22. "So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are also being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit."
All right, these Gentiles, they are stones in the temple of God, right along with the Jews. What is the temple? The church. Now my question is this. When Jesus said, "Tear down the temple, I'll build it again in 3 days." We know that later his disciples understood he was talking about his resurrection. But the Old Testament temple, it would be destroyed. It would mark an end to the practices of Judaism as a nation. What then would be God's dwelling among his people? Be the church. Not this physical structure anymore. It'd be that these Gentiles and Jews are a part of, fellow
stones or partakers of this spiritual temple. Now, having understood that, was Stephen preaching against the temple? Well, no. No, he wasn't preaching against the temple. He was talking about what the temple represented. He was talking about that which was to come, not that physical structure. Now, let's go back, if you will, in Acts the 7th chapter, and let's just carry forward the arguments of Stephen as he makes them. Acts chapter 7, let's begin, if you would please, Randy, at verse 5. You read verses 1 through 4. If you would please now read verse 5 and verse 17, please.
But he gave him no inheritance in it, not even a foot of ground. And yet, even when he had no child, he promised that he would give it to him as a possession and to his descendants after him. Verse 17. But as the time of the promise was approaching, which God had assured Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt.
All right, two things I want to note. One, when God made this promise unto Abraham, he had no child. When he came into the land of Canaan without a child, in Genesis, the 15th chapter, you recall that Abraham essentially asked, how shall I know that this land is going to be mine? And how did God respond to him, Jenny? How shall I know this land is going to be mine? Well, the fact is, it's not going to be yours per se. It's going to belong to your descendants 400 years from now. That's how that's going to happen. 400 years from now, that's going to be yours. But now, question, how could that come to pass, Denise, when he didn't have a child? Oh, yes, it is. Well, we know that Abraham believed what God said. In Romans chapter 4, when his body was yet as good as dead, we know that he and Sarah had a child. Now, we know the mechanics of that. We know how that happens. Abraham believed what God said. And here's Abraham and Mrs. Abraham that conceived a child in their ripe old age. You suppose they would do that or have done that if they'd not believed what God said? Their very conduct is indicative of the fact they believed they could conceive a child. Number two. When God said to Abraham, take your son and take him upon the mountain that I will show thee of and kill him. How's that all going to come to pass? 400 years from now, a great nation is going to descend from you, and they're going to inherit this land. How's that going to happen, Denise, if you take this child and you go up there and you kill him? Faith in what?
God's promise.
That's right. God had promised, I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to make of you a great nation, and they're going to possess this land. Now, if you kill that boy, that's not going to be the end of the story, is it? What did Abraham believe God would do or could do to go ahead and keep his promise? He could raise him from the dead. God could do that. He could raise him from the dead. Now, when we read about the faith that Abraham has in what God has said, he believed what God said. I think sometimes we just miss that. I really do. I think we just miss that. We miss that in our definition of faith. We say, well, faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. And we compare it that back, and that's accurate. But in the practical side, the application side, how was Abraham's faith demonstrated? He was willing to act when God told him to act, when he didn't understand how in the world that's going to happen. But here's what God promised. And I know that God will do what He says. Now, there are all kinds of illustrations of that that are beyond the scope of our study just here. We could throw in, for example, the Lord's instruction to be baptized. You see any connection with being immersed in water and remission of sins? None at all. But you do that because God said, when you are baptized, I'll wash away your sins by the blood of Christ. Now, I don't understand the connection of that, but I know that's what it says. And so consequently, that's what we must do. Somebody said, well, you know, Paul said that we're baptized into the death of Christ. I'm familiar with the arguments, made them myself. But to understand the connection, do you? No. No. But you do that because God said. Abraham believed what God said. Now, when we look at the text here, as Randy has read for us in verse 5, he had no child.
In verse 6, God spake on this wise that his seed should sojourn in a strange land, and that they should bring them into bondage and treat them ill 400 years. Now again, Jenny, this takes us back to Genesis chapter 15. You're not going to inherit the land, Abraham. But 400 years later, your descendants will. Now what's going to happen to your descendants for a period of time? They're going to be slaves. They're going to be slaves. Now, after this period of time has lapsed, what am I going to do? God said to Abraham in Genesis 15. Sarah? Okay. God said to Abraham, I'm going to do something after this 400 years to that nation that has held these people captive. What's God going to do? He's going to bring them out. That's right. He's going to bring them out with great substance. In fact, the Egyptians, he said, are going to give you everything they've got. Anything you want to get rid of you. And they'll come out. Right? Okay. All right. So that's what's going to take place. They would be ill-treated for 400 years. And then in verse 7, and the nation to which they shall be in bondage will I judge, said God. And after that they shall come forth and shall serve me in this place. Gonna come here. Gonna serve me after 400 years. Now verse 8 begins a new segment. It says, and gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begat Isaac and circumcised him the eighth day. And Isaac begat Jacob, and Jacob the 12 patriarchs. And the patriarchs moved with jealousy against Joseph and sold him into Egypt. And God was with him, and they delivered him out of all of his, out of all his afflictions, and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and made him governor over Egypt and all his house. What is it that God is promising unto Abraham now? Covenant of circumcision. What's that mean? Genesis 17. What was significant about the covenant of circumcision? It was to be with Abraham and those who descended from him, a certain lineage. That became an identifying characteristic. These people are mine. Do you find it interesting, Randy, in the passage, I'm picking on you this morning, in the passage that you read, I just forgot the passage that I asked you to read a moment ago. The covenant of Ephesians 2 is where I'm thinking. Ephesians 2. That the terms circumcision and uncircumcision are set in contrast. The circumcision, who were they? The Jews. The uncircumcision, the Gentiles. When we use the term circumcision, it was a term that was used, or a practice that was used, to identify God's people, those who had descended from Abraham. In verse 9, it says, and the patriarchs moved with jealousy. Now, who were the patriarchs? Against Joseph, and sold him into Egypt. Who did that? His brothers. God was with him, that is, with Joseph, and delivered him out of all of his afflictions, and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and made him governor over the house of Egypt. Now we know that the brothers were burned with jealousy and envy, and they wanted Joseph dead. But who was it spoke up for him? Reuben. Let's put him in a pit, and I'll come back and get him, is what the plan was. In the interim, what happened to him? Brother sold him to a caravan that was going down into Egypt. Well, we know the series of events. Now, one of the things that we do want to note about Stephen's rehearsal, if you please, of the history of these people is its brevity. There are a lot of things that happen in the life of Joseph. In fact, from Genesis, what is it, about chapter 35, 36 or so, toward the end then of the book of Genesis. Long narrative dealing with the life of Joseph. But very simply here, Stephen just says he was in Egypt and God made him a prince during this time to prepare for the people during the days of the famine. Now all the details of that we don't have in Stephen's account. We have to go back to the account of Genesis to bring that out. In verse 11, he says, why do you wrong one another? Now, therefore, why do you wrong one another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, who made thee a ruler and a judge? And I've just read from one page to the next. Pardon me. Verse 11. Now there were, or came a famine. All right, I left out about 20 verses. Came a famine over all Egypt and Canaan, and a great affliction. And our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent forth our fathers the first time. And at the second time, Joseph was made known to his brethren. And Joseph's race became manifest unto Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and called to him his father and all the kindred, 75 souls. And Jacob went down to Egypt, and he died, himself and our fathers, and they were carried over unto Shechem, and laid in a tomb that Abraham brought, or bought rather, for a price in silver of the sons of Hamor in Shechem. But at that time, I want to pause right there, verse 17. We'll pick up there in just a moment. You see then the brevity with which Stephen presents this presentation about the family of Joseph going down into Egypt. There's one thing that I do want to call to your attention, and I don't know what the explanation of it is. If you're comparing notes, you'll compare the notes of chapter 7, verse 14, to the text of Exodus chapter 1. And there in Exodus chapter 1, we learn that there were 70 souls that were brought up, or brought down from Canaan to the land of Egypt. How many does Stephen say here? 75. Now you'll note that back in the Genesis account, chapter 46, I believe it is. 75 here, 70 in the Old Testament text. Now, the reconciling of that, I frankly don't know. When we get into some of the numbers and say, well, that's just a little bit off, I don't know the answer to that. Some have suggested as a plausible explanation of this that here Stephen is counting not only the immediate family of Jacob, but also might consider some of the household servants and so forth that came down with him. I don't know. I just don't know. But be that as it may. Another point that you might want to take note of in verse 16, it said they were carried over into Shechem and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for the price of in silver of the sons of Hamor in Shechem. Who bought the price from the sons of Hamor in Shechem? If you go back to the text, that would be Jacob that did that, and we'll have to pass over that as well as far as an explanation is concerned. The point I want you to see is, but as the time of the promise drew nigh, which God vouchsafed unto Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt. Point. You ever talk with a premillennialist who believes that at the second coming of the Lord, there's going to be some kind of a rising up of the nation of Israel, some kind of a mass transportation of Israelites to the land of Canaan? You ever had that discussion? Okay? Most of us have at one point or another. Folks believe, when that is being taught, that there's going to be some kind of a restoration, future restoration of the land of Israel, the nation of Israel. When God made promise unto Abraham regarding the fulfillment of the nation promise, what became the threshold of the fulfillment of that promise? According to Stephen. Look, if you will, again, verse 17. But as the time of the promise drew nigh, which God vouchsafed unto Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt. When the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, we're on the threshold of the fulfillment of the promise that God made to Abraham. Now, one of the things that we have to take home with us on that is he's not punching the clock down 2, 3, 4, 5,000 years into the future. When the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, this was the timeline that indicated the threshold of the fulfillment of that promise. Do we see that? Now, when you look at the development of the timeline, when they came up out of the land of Egypt as a great nation, They wandered in the wilderness for how long?
40 years.
40 years. Being identified then in Exodus chapter 19, just after they came up out of the land of Egypt as a holy nation, 40 years later, what did they receive?
The land.
The land. Now, you want to kick the can down thousands of years when you can already identify the events on the timeline very near to the time that they were growing in Egypt, just like Stephen said. Now, question. Does everybody see that point? That's an important thing for us to take home.
Imagine, it's my guess, when Stephen was telling them this, they realized that they could have been in there 2 years instead of 40. And he's backtracking on the history of telling them. So I think that helped make them mad too.
Well, it very, very likely did. But what he's telling them is that all the way down through history, after the development of the nation, he's not gotten to that yet. But from the development of the nation, it is historically Israel that has rejected Moses, the law, the temple, the customs. You've rejected all of that, and you're accusing me of doing that. Now, he gets to the point a little bit later on in verse 57. But if you'll note now, continuing in verse 18, he said, "Till there arose another king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. The same dealt craftily with our race and ill-treated our fathers, that they should cast out their babes to the end that they might not live." Now, who does that introduce us to? What were the events ordered by Pharaoh? Sarah?
Kill all these little boys.
That's right. You kill all these little boys. Well, what does that introduce us to, Lynn?
Well, that's when Moses' mother put him in the ark.
Yes, and where then was Moses raised?
In the household of
Pharaoh. That's right. Look at verse 20. Verse 20 of Acts chapter 7. "At which season Moses was born and was exceeding fair, and he was nourished 3 months in his father's house. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son." Now that just fits like a glove with the historical account that we see in Exodus chapter 1 and chapter 2 and so forth. Verse 22, "And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in his works," or his words and works. Now again, you can go back to the Exodus account and see the evidence of that. You also might find it just a little bit, I guess, interesting from Luke's account that Jesus was a prophet, and he was described as mighty in word before God and before all of the people. So the similar words used to describe both Moses and Jesus, but Moses prophesied concerning the coming of Jesus. So if you reject Jesus, you reject Moses who pointed the way. And that's the argument that Jesus makes in John chapter 5. Now look, if you will, at verse 23. "But when he was well nigh 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren and children, the children of Israel." How did that come into the heart of Moses? What happened? You know this. How did Moses decide to go back to Egypt? Alright. He did. He was 40 years old. But when he was 40 years old, he wanted to go see. And this is what he found. He saw the Egyptian killing or beating up on one of his brethren, as it were. So he killed the Egyptians. Now verse 24. "And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed, smiting the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God by his hand was giving him them deliverance, but they understood not." Now what's the evidence of that? Verse 26. They didn't understand. Jenny? Verse 26. "And the day following, he appeared unto them as they strove, and would have set them one at one again, saying, Sirs, you are brethren, why do ye wrong one another?" And what'd they do? Right here on the inauguration of Moses, if you please, what did they do?
Accused him of murder.
So again, the nation of Israel has rejected Moses while they were still in Egypt. Verse 29. Moses fled at this saying and became a sojourner in the land of Midian, where he begat two sons. Now, Moses, while he was in Midian, married Zipporah, who was the daughter of Jethro, priest of Midian. And Moses had two sons born in Midian. Now, when the 40 years were fulfilled, how old is Moses now, Denise? 80. When the 40 years were fulfilled, an angel appeared unto him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, in a flame of fire and a bush. And when Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight, and as he drew near to behold, there came a voice of the Lord. I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, and of Isaac, and of Jacob. And Moses trembled, and durst not behold. And the Lord said unto him, loose the shoes from off or from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Now let's pause again. Takes us back again to the Old Testament text of Exodus, doesn't it? And you recall the presentation of the Lord in the form of the burning bush, and we note that Moses was afraid to look at it. God said, the place whereon you stand is holy ground. Well, did the dirt of that particular place bear any significance? Was it different from the dirt on the other side of the mountain? No, that's not the point. What is the point then, David? God is here. That's right. Stephen is trying to help these Jews in his age to understand what took place that resulted in the blessing of God upon these people. Verse 34. I have surely seen the affliction of my people that is in Egypt, and have heard their groanings, and I am come down to deliver them, and now come, I will send thee into Egypt. This Moses, whom they refused, saying, who made thee a ruler and a judge? Him hath God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer with the hand of the angel that appeared to him in the bush. Notice, if we would, again, how that Stephen points out that this Moses that you initially rejected while Moses was still in Egypt, when he told these folks, your brethren, don't fight with each other. This Moses is the one that God has made now a ruler and a deliverer. And what was it those two fellows said? Moses, who made you a ruler over us? But God made him a ruler. And how had they responded? They had rejected him. In verse 36, this man led them forth, having wrought wonders and signs in Egypt, in the Red Sea, and in the wilderness, 40 years. This is that Moses who said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall God raise up unto you from among your brethren like unto me. Question. Pick your brain. Where did Moses say that?
Deuteronomy
18. That's right. A prophet shall God raise up. Moses said that. Now, that's going to be significant in just a moment when we see that that prophet came and you rejected him. Verse 38. This is he that was in the church in the wilderness with the angel that spake to him in Mount Sinai with our fathers who received living oracles to give unto us. Two or three things I want us to note in that verse. Number one is the use of the word church. Becomes evident in this passage as well as some other passages that the word church simply means what? What's its definition? Pardon me? Group of people. It's called out body of people. Now, this church in the wilderness, this called out body of people in the wilderness, who was that?
Israelites.
Israelites. That's right. And God gave them living oracles at this time when they were at Mount Sinai. In verse 39, to whom our fathers would not be obedient, but thrust him from them and turned back in their hearts into Egypt. Now, note number two. They rejected Moses when Moses tried to separate these brothers that were fighting. They rejected Moses when Moses gave unto them the law. While he was on the mountain receiving the law, they rejected Moses. Now, the interesting point that we want to note in verse 39 is the fathers would not be obedient, but thrust him from them and turn back in their hearts unto Egypt. What they want. The idea of their hearts being thrust back to Egypt. What was in Egypt that was in their hearts? Yes. The idols. That's right. The idols of Egypt. Why do you suppose when they said to Aaron, up make us gods that should go before us because this Moses, we don't know what's happened to him, and they made a golden calf. Where'd that come from? They just dreamed that up out of the sky, say, we want to have a calf. We'll worship that thing. Well, no. This was Egypt. This was Egypt. This was their history. And so we want you, Aaron, to get up and make us a calf that shall go before us, and we can declare this thing to be our God. Look at verse 41. And they made a calf in those days and brought a sacrifice unto the idol and rejoiced in the works of their hands, but God turned and gave them up to serve the host of heaven. As it is written in the book of the prophets, did ye offer unto me slain beasts and sacrifices 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? And ye took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of the god of Rephan, the figures which ye made to worship them, and I will carry you away beyond Babylon. Now think with me for just a moment. This quotation, by the way, comes from Amos chapter 5, verses 25 and 26. This is what you did. You offered unto me beast. Or you offered beasts and sacrifices, and you offered sacrifices unto Molech and to the god Rephaim. What had God said He would do when they worshiped idols? Take away your land. I'm going to destroy it from off this good land. What is it that they are now doing? Worshiping idols. Just exactly like Moses told them that they would, just exactly like Joshua told them that they would. And they said, no, we won't ever do that. We won't do that. You see, it's God who brought us out of Egypt. It's God who allowed us to cross the Red Sea. It's God who's blessed us with food and water during the days of the wilderness. Why? We won't ever do that.
Verse 42 says, it was not to me that you offered victims and sacrifices. And then in verse 43, it says, you also took along the tabernacle of Moloch. Well, Moloch was the idol god that they offered their children to.
That's right.
Victims.
That's right. Caitlin and I talked a little bit about that, and her response was rather interesting to me. When you talk about Molech, my understanding was it was some kind of an image that was built out of metal and had an opening where the hands of the thing was, where you could build a fire underneath it, and here you've got a big old pan in the hands of this thing, and people would throw their babies into that hot pan as an offering unto this idol god. Now, do you think God was happy with that? Of course not. God told them, here's what's going to happen to you if you do that, and they did that anyway. What had Moses told them in the giving of the law? Thou shalt not have any other gods before me. You shall not have any graven images, etc., etc. And that's what they did. Pardon me? Yeah, commandment number one. And they did the very thing that Moses, by the will of God, had instructed them not to do. All right. Well, we'll have to stop there. And the point that we'll pick up with, Richard, I guess next time, or how you want to handle the arrangement, is going to be their captivity in Babylon. And as the writer continues. All right, thank you.